Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rohenbacher.
And it is Clark's birthday. We are very excited. He is behind the camera making this show happen along with our director. So we just want to wish him a happy birthday and then talk about what's going to be on this episode.
Well, thanks. I actually didn't even know it was birthday. So happy birthday, Clark. Hope it's a good one. I'll write it on Facebook later so it's official.
Yes.
Anyway, so today's show, RTB 101. We're going to be hearing from biochemist Fuzzle Rana as he answers the question, how does evolution account for stasis?
And in Give and Take, Jeff Swerenk will be chatting with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples on Augustine and existentialism. Deep.
That is deep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like to avoid that topic.
Yeah. But,
so I'm glad Ken is here to actually approach it, though, because people need answers and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, it's a heavy topic, but I think he brings some clarity to it.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, first up is Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be speaking with astrophysicist Hugh Ross, and they're going to be discussing if science is trustworthy. The answer might surprise you.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with astrophysicist Hugh Ross. Thank you for joining us, Hugh.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to talk about a big question that some Christians might have, and that is if science is trustworthy. But before we go there, I think it's helpful for viewers and listeners to kind of know a little bit about your background, because you started first as a scientist. You were not a Christian. So can you unpack what that journey was like for you?
Well, my parents said I was born a scientist. I was doing experiments since I was two. And when I was seven, I got really interested in the stars. Mm-hmm. And you know, I knew astrophysics would be my career from the age of eight onwards. I was reading everything I could get my hands on. Mm-hmm. Wound up doing some research on T-Tauri-type stars during my teenage years.
Wow.
So I won the BC Science Fair, won the Journal Prize when I went on as an undergraduate to the university. Mm-hmm. I've always been captivated by what I saw in science, and especially in the cosmology of the universe.
So yeah, you've been clearly always in love with science, but you weren't a believer of any sort of faith, but you started to explore that really from a scientific method, correct?
Yeah, it was my science that persuaded me there had to be a God, mm-hmm. and it was my science that persuaded me it had to be the God of the Bible. And so, yeah, astronomy brought me to faith in Christ. Lisa had a big part of it.
Yeah, and how did you use science to come to the conclusion that the God of the Bible is the correct one?
Well, when you look at the universe, mm-hmm. It's clear that, I mean, it's incredibly big, incredibly complex, wonderfully designed to make our existence possible. Mm-hmm. So it speaks about a designer. The beginning of the universe is what struck me first. When I was 16, I realized the universe must have a beginning. There's a beginning, there must be a beginner. And the way the universe is designed, it must be a personal beginner. Mm.
And so you started kind of systematically going through the world's holy books, and you used the scientific method, which I think is really interesting. What happened when you used the scientific method and you were exploring the Bible?
Well, looking at the universe, I could see that there was harmony there and consistency. There was purpose there. Mm-hmm. So I went through the world's holy books saying, if these books are inspired by the one that created the universe, it's going to have the same characteristics. Mm-hmm. It won't be filled with contradictions. Mm-hmm. The scientific data in there will be correct, mm-hmm. historically and geographically. So I purposely looked for inconsistencies, contradictions, scientific, historical, and geographical errors. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed is many of these holy books attempted to predict the future. So I said, well, if it's one that created the universe, I can see that God having the power to know the future. And so I would also test their predictions.
Yeah, and one of the things that I know just about you and your testimony is how you looked at the creation days and how you connected that to the scientific method, particularly establishing the point of view. So can you explain what that means?
Well, I was taught the scientific method when I was in grade one. We got it every single grade. Mm-hmm. So I was immersed in that through my public education. Mm-hmm. But I was stunned when I picked up the Bible for the first time to give it a serious read at age 17 to see the scientific method laid out there right on the first page. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact, you know, step one of the scientific method, do not interpret until you establish the point of view or the frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Step two, don't interpret until you establish the initial conditions. And you see that in Genesis 1-2. It tells us that the point of view, the Spirit of God is hovering on the surface of the waters. Mm-hmm. That's the frame of reference in which we understand the 6 days. Mm-hmm. And it gives you four initial conditions. It tells us that water is everywhere in the surface. It's dark everywhere in the surface. The earth is empty of life and unfit for life. And so I was rather surprised to see this in the Bible. It took me 9 more years to discover why the Bible so perfectly followed the scientific method. That's where the scientific method came from, so we shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, no, that's really, I think, encouraging for those scientifically minded people who are also of the Christian faith. They can feel hopefully affirmed that it's a good thing to explore science.
Well, one thing I saw in the other holy books, Sandra, was an appeal to subjective testing. If this feels good, you know it's true. Mm-hmm. But consistently, the Bible commands us put everything to the test, mm-hmm. put it to a rigorous test and an objective test. That was unique to the Bible, and then it actually shows you how to put things to the test.
Well, when we talk about science today, and things are shifting, you know, things continue to shift, some would say that it's because we shouldn't trust science, that the Bible is trustworthy, science is not, because it changes over time. How do you explore that from a Christian perspective and astrophysicist perspective as well?
Well, probably put it in the context of Daniel 12:4. Mm-hmm. At the time of the end, knowledge will explosively increase. And we see this particularly in the book of nature, the scientific record. We're making new discoveries at an explosive rate today, thanks to the intensity of scientific research. So science is changing in that the book of nature is getting bigger and bigger and more comprehensively understood. Mm-hmm. It's not that the old science has been overturned. I mean, notice that we still use Newtonian mechanics to send spaceships to the distant planets. Yes, there is a relativistic correction, but it's so extremely tiny in that context, there's no need to apply it.
Mm. Well, let's say you have someone who isn't scientifically minded and they are of the Christian faith. What do you do to kind of encourage them to have a little trust in the scientific enterprise and something that they can be excited about?
Well, if they're a Christian, they probably mm-hmm. already have a trust in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a doctrine called perspicuity, which mm-hmm. is a fancy word for clarity, mm-hmm. that the most important messages in the Bible are clear and repeated and have always been understood by Christians through all generations. Mm-hmm. But there are large parts of the Bible where we're still making discoveries. I mean, we had the exhortation in 1 Peter that future generations will know more than the previous generations. It's the same thing with the book of nature. Mm-hmm. Future generations know more than previous generations. But guess what? All those generations understand that the record of nature reveals a law of gravity. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's not being changed. Or as a number of scientists have said, when we do our scientific research, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. So we're standing on the shoulders of people like Isaac Newton, James Clerk Maxwell. We still teach our students the science that they discovered. Yes, we're adding more, we're refining what they have established, but we're not overturning it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. So what would be a good resource for anyone who's curious to know why science is trustworthy and how it affirms the Christian faith?
Well, a good place to go would be the Bible, because the Bible tells us
yes,
in Psalm 19
there.
that there is a record of nature. Mm-hmm. God has given us his book. He speaks his book. It's a God that can't lie or deceive. Yeah. It can be trusted. Mm-hmm. But also, just read some good introductory, say, freshman-level college books on different disciplines of science, mm-hmm. and you're going to see that principle laid out, mm-hmm. Where the authors basically show you all the old science, mm-hmm. why it can be trusted, and why we can build on that to discover science we don't already know.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for that, Hugh. If you'd like to hear more from Hugh Ross. Go to reasons.org and search for his blog, Today's New Reason to Believe.
All right. So yeah, I'm just finishing up your book on Who Was Adam, and I just want to say, first of all, incredible. I was just really gripped by it. And if anybody's interested remotely in human origins, you got to pick it up. That being said, I want to try and fit in, hopefully, compress a couple questions. So the first, during the course of the book and elsewhere, it's I want to know how does an evolutionary biologist or an evolutionist account for the stasis? And then I came up with my own sarcastic kind of like poking term, because everywhere you see throughout the fossil record, I came up with the term instantaneous gradual macroevolution, because everywhere you see, it's just, it bursts into existence. And then things like Homo ergaster erectus, you have this just 1 million years of no change in tool use. So it seems to contradict the basic tenet and paradigm of evolutionary theory. And if I could fit in one other kind of idea that I deduced in the course of the book, I noticed like when humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, come on scene, there's the possibility for religious expression, but that's not there. But to me, that seems that can be somewhat indicative, even if only indirectly, of the idea of no graven image. And then throughout human history, some anthropologists call human beings homo religioso. So it seems like that could actually fit in our own paradigm.
Yeah.
If you could comment on that, that'd be outstanding.
Yeah. Well, with respect to the first question, you know, I would agree with you, this idea of that things appear suddenly and then there's stasis, to me, is something that I think fits better in a creation model framework than an evolutionary framework. And what's interesting is when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, he had a chapter devoted to problems with his theory. And one of those problems was basically that things appear suddenly and don't seem to undergo change in the fossil record. Now, Darwin argued that, you know, paleontology and geology are relatively in their infancy at the time that he wrote the book, and he felt that as people characterized the geological column, more fossils would be discovered, and these patterns that were troubling to his theory would actually disappear, and what was needed to support the theory would come into focus. Well, that hasn't happened in 160 years. Instead, what we see is the patterns that troubled Darwin about the fossil record are patterns that still persist today. And so I see this as essentially a failed prediction. And so I would agree that that's problematic. Now, you have people, and this is, of course, a number of years ago now, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Aldridge proposed this idea of punctuated equilibrium. And punctuated equilibrium was basically a model that essentially it really described the patterns in the fossil record. It didn't really explain them. But Gould and Aldridge were basically saying, look, we need to be honest about what the patterns actually show. And what we're looking for doesn't exist. And so these are the patterns. And so people have struggled to try to explain, again, how you would have these very rapid transitions in the fossil record, again, followed by stasis. In my view, I've never seen really a compelling mechanism that was presented. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this idea for religious capacity is that since I've written the update to Who Was Adam, I've been spending more additional time just studying the archaeological record, and in the process have come across work by an archaeologist, anthropologist by the name of David Lewis Williams, who offers an interpretation of the art that we see. And it turns out that we now have evidence for art in Southeast Asia that's actually slightly older than the art in Europe, and that art is identical. The same type of hand stencils, the same type of animal depictions, and it's throughout Southeast Asia. So this is really indicating that artistic expression existed in humanity well before we began to migrate around the world. In fact, there's rock art produced by the San that dates at about 72,000 years in Africa that it also has certain elements about it that's similar to the cave art that we see in Europe. And in fact, Shiragu Magawa, who is a linguist at Harvard University, no, check that, at MIT, actually argues that if the San are making art at 72,000 years that is similar to the art in Europe and in Asia, the San diverged from the human lineage about 125,000 years ago, which means that artistic capacity must exist prior to about 125,000 years ago, which is about when we're beginning to see evidence for the modern human anatomy appear in the fossil record. This is where you begin to see the globular skull shape. Now, what's interesting is David Lewis Williams actually argues that the art reflects a deeply religious culture. And he argues that the art is essentially representation of the visions that shaman would have had. And so he argues that the very first humans actually had a complex picture of reality, where there was a physical reality and an immaterial reality, and that immaterial reality or that spirit realm influenced the physical realm. And he argues that people viewed that deeper into the earth you went, the closer you got to that spirit realm where the spirits resided. And he argues that the cave walls represented the veil between the two realms, and that the shaman would go into these caves, go into a hallucinogen-induced trance, would have these visions that were then depicted on the walls. And these depictions are in these incredibly difficult to access chambers in these caves, and they're massive in scope. But he also argues that the hand stencils that you saw were actually attempts with people trying to connect with the spirit realm. And so there's areas in the cave wall where you see these hand stencils everywhere. And he argues that this is a deeply religious experience. And in fact, the San rock art in Africa that dates at 72,000 years is in a place where you get this really interesting acoustical effect that complements the art. And that acoustical effect, he believes, was interpreted by them as being the spirit realm communicating with the physical realm. And so the idea that humans have a religious capacity, I think, is reflected in the nature of the artwork, or at least in David Lewis Williams' interpretation of the art. So he doesn't see it as merely depicting the world around us as first humans, but rather reflecting a deeply ingrained religious system. And obviously it would be a religious system that would have been a strong deviation from what Adam and Eve would have experienced in their relationship with God. But of course, that kind of makes sense when you read what Scripture teaches, right? Yeah. About the rebellion of humanity.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here. Welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important intellectual ideas and see how they relate to the truth of Christianity. And today I'm excited because I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Ken Samples, and we are going to talk about St. Augustine and existentialism. Ken, good to have you on the program today.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
So we're going to delve into some philosophical ideas here, and one of those is existentialism. It seems like this cool 10-letter word. Kind of flesh out, what is existentialism from a philosophical perspective?
Well, think about that key word, exist. So existentialism is a philosophy that explores human existence. It's interested in questions like the meaning and purpose and significance of individual people's lives. And it has a rich history. Philosophers, both religious and non-religious, have been attracted to it.
So can you give us just some maybe some opposing views or different ways of looking at it? Because it seems, you know, thinking about purpose and meaning, that just seems kind of second nature. What would people be doing something other than existentialism?
Well, one part of existentialism is the question, why do human beings seem to be lacking fulfillment and satisfaction in life? What is it that causes kind of human angst and a lack of ultimate contentment? So it's kind of an exploration of human psychology. It's a reflection on you know, what's the fundamental flaw in human nature that makes humans the way that they are.
So in talking about that, it kind of seems like, I mean, that just sits very, aligns very well with Christianity. I mean, there is a deep flaw in human nature. There's reasons why we're not fulfilled, experience angst. Is this a secular or a theistic worldview or philosophy?
Yeah. Well, partially it is how it's defined. Let me illustrate that by saying this, that a secular philosopher who is an existentialist would say, I just exist, and through my own efforts, my own choices, I create my own essence, I identify my being. A Christian existentialist would flip it and say, no, you're born with an identity. That identity is you're made in the image of God, and you can fulfill that identity by becoming a Christian. So the secularist would say, all you have is existence. God can't give you meaning and purpose. You have to do that yourself. So in some ways, secular existentialism is a reaction to a Christian existentialism.
So if I get what you're saying, existentialism is exploring the angst and the fulfillment and the purpose and the good and that sort of stuff, where the secular and the theistic might differ on where the origin of those things are. They both agree that they're there and they're wrestling trying to understand them. Is that a good way to look at it?
And who has the better explanation? And maybe a bit of a historical context. Secular existentialism really exploded right after World War II. I mean, European civilization is devastated. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to find an intact building in an entire town. So, you know, this was a very depressing time. This was a period where people thought humans are not altruistic. Look at all the death.
Right.
So how are we to find meaning in a world that seems in many ways to lack altruism and lack goodness?
So is this a dominant theme in philosophy? I mean, are there lots of people who've done this, or is this kind of more peripheral or niche, if you will, in philosophical thought?
I would say, for example, Søren Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, he kind of lived an obscure life. Nobody really knew him or his writings other than people who had contact with him. But by the middle of the 20th century, a century after his death, everybody knew Kierkegaard. Hmm. So I think there have been forerunners of existentialism, along with some very influential 20th century existentialists. And again, I think because it's about the identity of human beings and their purpose and their meaning, I think it attracts people, secular or religious.
So I know you've written a blog that talks about this and that there's a connection between existentialism and St. Augustine.
Yeah.
And I know you like to talk about St. Augustine.
Sure.
So what is the connection and why is St. Augustine being connected to this important?
Well, you know, we often think that maybe Søren Kierkegaard in the 19th century is the father of existentialism, or maybe in the 20th century we think the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre is the ideal existentialist. But many of these themes that are attractive to both religious and non-religious philosophers, you see in the writings of St. Augustine. In his book, The Confessions, which is kind of his autobiography, he talks about angst. He talks about limitations and our fallenness and how life is not meaningful without discovering God. We find rest and peace for our soul in God. Some people have said, look, these are major philosophical themes. And Augustine is already, you know, in the 5th and 6th century, 4th and 5th century, he is already looking at these. I think it's fair to say Augustine had an existential mindset.
That's pretty remarkable because he's predating the folks you're talking about by a millennia. You know, so the fact that he's wrestling with those and, you know, kind of flesh it out a little bit. But I think he plays a prominent role in Christian thought, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, all of the existentialists know Augustine. I mean, Søren Kierkegaard was a fan of St. Augustine, Blaise Pascal, fan of Augustine. But even the secular people, Derrida, Sartre, all of these people read St. Augustine and they were aware of him. So, you know, here is a book that created the genre of the autobiography, and he's still speaking to people, and even some people who are not dedicated Christians as he was.
So kind of touch a little bit about, on St. Augustine's connection to Christianity. I think you said he was a 5th century British monk, if I'm correct, or...
His dates are 354 to 430. Okay. He comes out of North Africa. Okay. That's where he is born. I would say that St. Augustine is arguably the most influential Christian thinker outside the biblical authors. Now, that's a big statement.
That is a big statement.
But I would say, for example, that it may be the case that Augustine influenced Protestants just as much as he has Catholics. He's not as well, he hasn't influenced the Eastern Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, quite as much as the Western Church, but Augustine's influence is profound. He influenced Anselm, he influenced Thomas Aquinas, he influenced Luther, Calvin, Ken Samples, the names go on and on.
Well, I mean, those are pretty prominent people in the history of the Christian Church. So that is a pretty remarkable thing.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Ken.
You bet.
You know, often when people look at the Christian Church and Christian thought, there's this perception that Christianity is kind of intellectually shallow. And what I find interesting about this discussion with Ken about St. Augustine and existentialism is how profound existential thought is in the philosophical community, and the fact that it traces back to St. Augustine, who lived many, many centuries ago and had profound influence on the Christian church. It really does show that Christianity has a profound, deep, and rich intellectual history that goes to it, and a faith that actually flows out of that intellectual history. You know, I'd encourage you to go to reasons.org. Ken's written about St. Augustine and existentialism. You can look up St. Augustine and the philosophy of existentialism. It'll give you a great blog that helps you understand not only St. Augustine, but the influence he had on existentialism and on us, everyone here today. That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show and also search for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts and maybe some ideas for future episodes.
And if you want the podcast version so you can hear us on the go, we are on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.